inside the feral zone.
Greetings, feral listeners. Welcome back inside the feral zone. I am Renee Komen, operating from an undisclosed location. Now, many of you know the Feral Zone is a sister podcast of the Troubled Men podcast. It appears in this space from time to time, and this is one of those times. Now, this might be the earliest we've ever started a podcast in the history of the whole operation. It's sun is shining bright outside. It's already blazing hot in New Orleans here. Sitting the home of one of our guests. He's a songwriter, singer, guitar player. He's recorded a couple of solo records that I played on over the last few years. And his most recent release is Make Your Own Weather, that just came out last week. We have a big record release show tonight at Chickiwawa. And we're going to get into all that and much more. But without further ado, the great Mr. Ned Henry. Welcome, Ned.
Renee, thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, man. Yeah, it's... this is quite an undertaking that you've achieved here. You know, this is a long time coming.
Well, this project's been about a year and a half in the works.
Right, right. But I mean, you've been writing songs your whole life. I know some of these songs date back.
Yeah, some of these songs date back to when I was like 15 years old.
Right on. Well, it's always good to be able to clear the books, you know.
That's so, right.
So this is second record I've done with you. I don't know, have you recorded other records before those?
So I did an ambitious double album when I was, you know, when my wife was pregnant with both of our kids. I did one record when she was pregnant with the first one, and the second disc of the compilation when she was pregnant with the second.
Okay.
It was a very ambitious 24 song record that at the time I was very proud of, and now it's kind of a demo when I listened back to it.
Sure, sure. Well,
it was done on Marantz four track.
Oh, right on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, those were great, those four track machines, man. It started in the whole collapse of the recording industry. That was the leading edge when everybody still had millions of dollars of equipment, and I thought, oh, you're gonna make a record in your bedroom, that'll never go anywhere. Well, but in fact, these records that we've done over at Blue Velvet Studio with the great Tom Stern, and he's brought in a number of people that I play in a whole bunch of different bands with. We had Russ Broussard on drums, myself playing bass, John Fole playing guitar, and then you've had other people that accessed Casey McAllister playing some keyboards and maybe some guitar. He's up there in, what, Virginia now, I think?
Yeah, yeah.
And who else have you had on these?
Well, on that first album, we had Doug Garrison, we had you.
Oh, right, right, right.
And we had Casey, and some of those guys I knew through Tom, and some people like you I knew through my work.
Right. And I think actually our first encounters may have been you being a fan of the Iguanas.
When I first moved here in 92.
Okay. Right on.
Yeah, you were our go-to band.
Nice, yep. Nice. Well, you know, that's the thing about New Orleans is it's so small, you're going to run into the same people over and over again. So, and this, it took me a long time to understand this, but I explained it to my children right off the bat, is don't make any enemies you don't absolutely have to make, because those people, you think you're gonna move on, no, you're gonna see those people over and over and over again. They may be deciding whether or not you get a loan. They may be your child's little league coach after that, you know.
It's a small town.
It's a very small town, and yes, and it runs on relationships. So,
100%.
So yes, we first you were my veterinarian at one time. I mean, not mine personally, my animals.
We took care of all your parasites, Renee.
Sure, sure. Well, I may need to check in with you again, because I may have picked up a few more. Been on the road with the Iguanas and Sonny Landreth, so who knows where. In fact, our other guest, I'll bring it. Maybe I should just get him in. Well, so for this record, you brought in the big guns.
Yeah. So this was really cool. This this whole record actually came out of a sort of a personal struggle I had. I had a problem with my hand.
Oh, right.
With my fretting hand. And when I came through it on the other side, I was just so grateful to be able to play guitar again.
Uh-huh. I'm
like, man, I am not going to take this for granted. And it's time to write some songs and get in the studio and not take it for granted. I could play
right
again. And that's where my journey here involved connecting with this hand doctor who turns out he's in New York. And one of my clients connected me with him when I was trying to navigate this issue.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a Zoom call with this guy, and he holds up his business card to the Zoom camera, and it says, "Keep the music playing" on the bottom.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, oh, wow. What's up with that? He's like, well, you know, like 99% of my patients are musicians with hand problems.
Yeah.
And so he said, I see you're 504. I'll be down at Jazz Fest in a couple of weeks, so I want to check your hand out in person.
Oh, nice.
And I said, oh, are you a big Jazz Fest guy? And he's like, well, a couple of my patients are performing at the fairgrounds. And I said, oh, who? And he's like, well, I can't say because of HIPAA, but let's call them Rick Ragger.
right.
And Heath Hitchards.
Uh-huh.
And anyway, this guy came down here and I got together with him, and he examined my finger and he said, look, so for now you've got an issue that you need to adapt to.
Mm.
And so we need to put light gauge strings in your guitars, get a capo, get some guitars in alternate tunings, get a slide, and work around your issue now, learn to adapt to it.
So he never actually did any surgery on you?
No.
Oh, wow.
No, there was no surgery.
Okay.
It was luckily.
Right.
In fact, he talked me out of going that route,
mm-hmm.
which was great. But he really gave me like a life lesson. And that's where this album is called Make Your Own Weather.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the things on here come from that experience.
Uh-huh.
Of, you know, you can't dictate your circumstances, but you can dictate how you respond to them.
There you go.
And so it led to this new batch of songs and this recording session that, you know, went on for a while because this is not my primary job.
Sure.
But at some point, Tom said, man, we need a pedal steel on this one track. And, you know, I'm trying to think who we could call. And, you know, I was thinking, why not reach out and see if I can find Doyle Grisham, who is Jimmy Buffett's longtime pedal steel player.
Right.
Who I've been a fan of since I started listening to music. And
sure.
Doyle played on Jimmy's albums from the early 70s and then forward, and has been touring with him since like 2000.
Right.
So I sent off a song to an email address that I found on the internet, and Doyle himself reached back out. And as I recall it, he said, I like your song. Are you asking me if I would play on this? And I'm like, and I had just said in my email, any chance Mr. Grisham could listen to my song?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, are you asking me if I would like to play on it? And I was like, would you? And he said, if I said yes, what would you want me to play? And I said, whatever you feel.
All right.
And then he said, I'll do it.
Nice.
And he sent back this amazing track. And then he said, you got any more?
Yeah.
And it kind of went from there.
Cool. Well, I guess it's a good a time as any to go ahead and finish the introduction for our very special guest we have in town from Nashville. He's a legendary pedal steel guitar player with Jimmy Buffett's Coral Reefer Band for more than 25 years. He's had an amazing career going back to the 1950s, including recording with artists such as Chet Atkins, George Jones, Tammy Wynette, Kitty Wells, Mel Tillis, Kenny Rogers, Len Anderson, on and on. He's also a record producer and engineer and studio manager at Fireside Studio in Nashville for a number of years. We're going to get into all that and more with him, but without further ado, the great Mr. Doyle Grisham. Welcome, Doyle.
Hey, thank you very much.
Man. Well,
glad to be here, Renee.
Man, such an honor. You know, it's like, it's hard for me to think about things more than one step ahead of time. And as I was, we had a long, great rehearsal yesterday with you, played for about 3 hours together. As I'm driving, as I'm driving home, I'm thinking to myself, why am I not having Doyle on the podcast? How can I let this opportunity pass me by?
Glad you thought of it. I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, so we had to wrangle some schedules around, but here we're meeting in this lovely undisclosed location here in the heart of Uptown New Orleans. So Doyle, well, first of all, do you do many like remote recordings these days, like Ned's project, where you're, you know, somebody sends you tracks and you...
Yeah, I do a lot of that for the Parrothead group. They call themselves Trop Rock now.
Right.
And but you know, that's Jimmy Buffett's followers.
Uh-huh.
People don't know that. But yeah, I do, over a period of years, I do, I guess, outside of Ned's, I've done maybe 6 to 10 songs this year.
Yeah.
That's the first year for different people
uh-huh.
that just... Like you say, they're doing a project like Ned did, and they want to put steel guitar on it, so they send me the track, and I put my part on it and send it back to them. And
right, they drop it in. And
yeah, they mix it, put it in their computer or wherever, and
sure.
mix it, and that's kind of how it's done nowadays.
Right, we got into that a lot during the pandemic when nobody could be in the same room, and then people got their setups and got used to doing it. And I mean, people were doing it before that to some degree, but it really is.
Well, in my day of playing studio work in Nashville, sometimes we were real lucky. Sometimes we'd be doing 6 to 10 sessions a week. And we'd always joke about, well, I wish we could phone our part in.
Yeah.
It's almost getting to that point.
Sure, sure. Now, I want to get into that. So you got to Nashville like in the 60s, huh?
Yeah, 66, I think, is when I showed up there.
But your career goes way back to, you're from Texas, huh?
Yep. Yeah, I'm from right in the center of Texas, which is big farm country.
Mm-hmm.
And I did my share of that when I was growing up. But, that's where I'm from. And when I was right out of high school, I moved to Dallas and started playing locally there, and also playing on a Saturday night show called the Big D Jamboree. It was kind of a local copy of the Grand Ole Opry.
Mm-hmm.
But back in its day, back in the 50s, it had... I guess it was broadcast mostly over the South, but it had a radio show that broadcast every night. Every Saturday night, it's like the Grand Ole Opry. But then, for whatever reason, I think a lot of the artists, just like on the Louisiana Hayride, which is another version.
Right, I was going to say, out of Shreveport. Yeah, same thing.
All those artists became big enough, they moved to Nashville, mm-hmm. so the shows kind of lost their... spontaneity or their
they didn't have the talent
they didn't have the talent anymore, and just had local people who hadn't proven themselves yet, so they just kind of folded, and a radio network didn't want to invest in a show that really didn't have
the big stars, right?
People on it.
So you started off as a regular electric guitar player, right?
Yeah, well, I was lucky enough I took guitar lessons when I was about 11 or 12 and had a good teacher and a good course. So by the time I was 14 years old, I was playing in church bands and this and that.
Mm-hmm.
Then within that year or maybe next year, I started playing locally with some of the bands that were playing nightclubs.
Uh-huh.
And...
While you're still in high school? While you're still a teenager?
Yeah,
right,
I was 14 years old, 15. And I guess I was a decent player, because I'd have to be decent enough to replace an adult.
Sure, sure.
They could have hired.
Now, do you come from a musical family? Your parents play?
Not necessarily. My uncle played out in bands, but mostly just my parents. That we just listened to radio. My mother always had the radio on a country station, and we listened to the Grand Ole Opry on Saturday nights, that type of thing.
They were okay with you going out and playing.
Oh, sure, yeah. In fact, it's kind of strange. People don't believe this, but see, I've had driver's license since I was 14.
Mm-hmm.
When you lived on a farm, you could, if you had to haul stuff into town, which I did, you could get I mean, just driver's license like we all have. Uh-huh. It was a legitimate driver's license. Full. 14 years old.
Uh-huh.
So I could, once my dad saw that I was going to be responsible enough, they quit going with me unless they might come out on a Saturday night.
Just to watch me,
but not to chaperone.
Right, right. You were living it as an adult since you're 14 or 15 years
exactly.
old. Right,
I mean,
right,
yeah.
Right.
So, and I had sense enough to not betray that trust.
Right.
And so I was a pretty good kid, you know.
Nice.
And probably mostly out of necessity, but I tried to be anyway.
Right. Well, you know, if you don't learn those responsible habits, if you develop bad habits early on, you usually don't wind up lasting. You know,
That's true.
You don't wind up whatever, you know, 60 something years later, being successful.
Well, who knows? Maybe it's helped me all through these years.
Absolutely. So. Absolutely. So, what kind of artists were playing in the Big D Jamboree?
Well, actually, they had local talent that were well known in the area, but also they would have a guest artist every Saturday night.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to back those artists up, just like we had a rehearsal yesterday for that stuff. We'd have a rehearsal at 6 o'clock or 6:30 to learn their songs, you know, but just things like that. I mean, they would have Grand Ole Opry guest stars.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason they could afford that is because it was a split bill. There was a club down the road called the Longhorn Ballroom. Hmm. I mean, it was owned by Bob Wills, you know,
sure.
big Western swing dude,
sure,
back in the day. But a guy named Dewey Groom bought it, and what he would do is split the bill with the Big D Jamboree on the artists.
Uh-huh.
So they'd play on the Big D Jamboree, and then when they got through, they'd go to this nightclub and play the rest of the night, do an appearance there.
Right.
So it was like Grand Ole Opry. It was big artists like Dottie West, Farron Young, Webb Pierce, just anybody you could name that was popular on the Grand Ole Opry would probably come and play at the Big D Jamboree.
Right. Now, you and I were talking yesterday after the rehearsal, and I was bringing up some names like, you know, George Jones and Johnny Paycheck, and you were saying, oh, yeah, I was tight with both of those guys.
Yeah, I knew both of them. In fact, I knew George off and on since I was probably 15, 16 years old.
Was that how you met them, through the Big D Jamboree?
Yeah, I'll tell you a funny joke about George, or a funny story.
Mm-hmm.
Later on, when I was about 18, I was working some shows with him, and he wanted to hire me to travel. But I kind of turned it down because I just didn't know whether to. I'd never traveled like that before, and I didn't know whether to trust it. But the story I'm going to tell is when I was, right before I started playing these nightclubs and things, I was trying to sing. I was like 12, 13 years old, so I was on a local Friday night show in Waco, Texas, which was just about 20 miles north of where I was born. And I was like one of the local guests, just come out and sing two songs or whatever, or three or four. But one night, George Jones was a guest. And we're talking about, this is probably about 1956 or so. And I didn't know it, that he wrote a lot of songs for artists.
Mm-hmm.
So I went out and part of my show, I remember I sang a song called You Done Me Wrong, Why Baby Why, several other songs. I didn't realize he wrote them.
Uh-huh.
When I come off stage, he met me, or just saw me backstage. He said, well, thanks for doing my show for me. I didn't know what he meant.
Sure.
But no, he had written those songs for those artists.
Uh-huh.
He wasn't popular then.
Oh, okay.
Except locally in Texas.
Uh-huh.
But then he became, you know, nationally known a few years later. But that was my first meeting with George.
Oh, okay.
But then, like I say, later on, maybe four years or so, I had to work a string of shows with him for a private promoter. And he offered me a job. He was putting together his first band to tour with. And I wish I'd have taken it now, but at the time, I don't know, I just turned it down.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, you do what seems right at the time. You
can, yeah, but like I say, I wish I'd have done it. Now, it might have been a good experience.
Sure, you know? Sure. Well,
and if it made me feel good that he wanted me to do it, because he'd already had a song called White Lightning. And several other songs, or maybe two or three others that were, got a national acclaim.
Right.
So he was on his way to being a big star. But I don't know, something just scared me off about it.
Right. But then you wound up recording with him.
Later on, right. I did. I recorded some with him.
Nice.
But he was a great singer. He was one of my favorite singers.
So. Holy cow, yeah. No, and great songwriter, like you said, man.
Oh, yeah.
And tremendous personality. I mean.
He was.
That's the only one. George,
he had a storied life, that's for sure.
Now, and I was mentioning Paycheck yesterday.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Now, again, you met him in Dallas. Is that
same thing? Mm-hmm. I met him at the Big D Jamboree. He was he had already started getting some acclaim because, as we talked about, he wrote a lot of great songs.
Yes.
And he wrote for a publishing company that had a record label called Little Darlin'. Mm-hmm. And so, within the last 20 years, they put out a compilation of the songs he had written. Mm-hmm. And you were talking about what a great songwriter he was. But at this time, we're talking about early 60s, maybe 63 or 4. He was a guest on this Big D Jamboree show that I played in the band. And we actually became good friends. As I was telling you, we'd play our show, and he would probably go to the Longhorn Ballroom and finish out the night, and I'd go play another club, and then we'd meet 12:00 at his motel room. I'd set up my steel, and he'd get out his guitar, and we'd sit there and sing and play, just me and him, all night long.
Yeah, and you know, people know of Paycheck. I mean, the average citizen listener from Take This Job and Shove It, you know, that, which is, you know, a great song. People saw it as a joke song, but it's really, you know, and he still sings great. But I mean, that version of Paycheck is only the latter day.
It is, yeah. He was a totally different person. I mean, you know, as you well know, people may know, he got in a lot of trouble later on in life and wound up shooting a guy in a bar.
Sure,
did some his ear or something.
Did some prison time.
Yeah, he did some prison time. And then when he came out, he still had a career and he started touring. But there was a lot of complications to his touring, you know. And
sure.
He didn't, health wise, he didn't last very long, you know. He probably died within 5-6 years of his popularity, his biggest popularity.
Right.
In the, I guess, late 70s, early 80s.
Right. Now, but back in the days when y'all were hanging out in Dallas together, he was clean shaven. As we were talking about yesterday, wrote all these great ballads, you know.
I think we sat there and played all night long and probably didn't even have a beer.
Yeah.
He certainly wasn't into any kind of substance. At that time, I didn't know what substance was.
Uh-huh.
You know, in this manner of what people have, you know,
right,
cocaine and all that stuff.
Right, right.
But, I don't know if we might have sipped on a beer one night, but we were just there to play music.
Just about the music,
yeah,
right?
But, man, we were all gung-ho when we were young about
Our
music, you know.
Sure, sure. Well, you're there playing with all these top names. What causes you to leave there and go to Nashville?
Well, just because I wasn't doing it at the level I wanted to do studio work.
Mm-hmm.
I was doing some in Dallas. I was doing studio work, and I was also playing on some jingles, you know, local jingles, mainly playing guitar.
Okay.
The guy, a friend of mine, would hire me to play because I could read music enough to play simple notes that he wanted on the
jingle. Could read charts, right?
Yeah. But I went to Nashville to get into the mainstream studio work. That's what I really wanted to do. And eventually, it took me a long way around the bush to do it, but I finally got to do most of what I set out to do.
Nice. Now, you went there with on your own or with a group?
Well, actually, I went there. I was working. It's hard to explain. I was tied up with the service. I knew I was going to have to go into the service.
Okay.
I'd already been drafted. And in the meantime, I found out I could leave the Army draft thing and join a Naval Reserve.
Mm-hmm.
I'd still have to do active duty. It was a special plan they had during the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
So I became a Naval Reserve active member,
mm-hmm.
but also had to do 2 years active duty. But in the meantime, while I was getting this all set up, people around Dallas knew I was going in the service. It's kind of hard to get a gig.
Yeah.
And so I was calling around trying to find if I could get some kind of work, because I really didn't know when they were going to send me on active duty.
Uh-huh. It was like a woman being pregnant. They're like, yes. Oh, you're not going to last long here, so I don't want to invest time in you.
I know.
Interesting.
So just out of the blue, some guy named Billy Thompson, who used to work with Hank Thompson, the big mm-hmm. Western swing band leader, he had a gig in Wichita, Kansas. He asked me if I'd want to go up there and play on Saturday night with him. So we drove up there, but it was a club big enough to where they had guest artists. They had a regular band like us,
uh-huh.
but they had guest artists every week. And a guy named Roy Drusky, who was on the Grand Ole Opry, was that guest that night.
Mm-hmm.
Well, ironically, his steel player was quitting the next day, and they asked me if I'd want to start playing in his band. So it was a chance to get to Nashville. So I said yes, and he was playing the next day in Houston. Now, this is Wichita, Kansas to Houston. I drove all night long, get on the stage with him, no rehearsal, because mm-hmm. I knew most of his stuff.
Yeah.
And we played the show. I came back through Dallas. I didn't even ask the reserve unit if I could move to Dallas. I said, send my records to Dallas.
Yeah.
I'm going to Nashville.
Nice.
So I wound up there and started playing. And then I was supposed to go on active duty within 2 or 3 months. But somehow or another, my records got misplaced or lost. they didn't call me to set up at me leaving, and I didn't push it.
Right, sure.
So I wound up staying in Nashville another year and a half, getting established with the local musicians
mm-hmm.
and working the Grand Ole Opry with Roy Drusky. And then finally they found out that I hadn't gone on active duty, and I had to eventually go in and do my time. But
caught you up.
Yeah, that's how I got to Nashville, though.
It shows you timing and proximity is everything in life, you know?
Yeah, it's being at the right place at the right time.
Sometimes. And being prepared enough to take advantage of that opportunity.
Yeah, and I always say it's who you know sometimes, but a lot of times it's who knows you.
Right.
Because if they're not aware of who you are, you're not going to get anywhere anyway.
Sure, yeah.
But that's how I got to Nashville. It was a long way around, but...
Right, well, that must have been a thrill, huh? I mean, like having listened to the Grand Ole Opry with your parents on the radio as a kid, and then now you're playing... Did you call your mother up excitedly?
Sure. Oh,
Mom,
yeah.
Listen, well, make sure you listen to the Opry I'm playing this
week. Of course, because I never thought I'd ever make it. I had the dream.
Right.
You just never know, you know. And I didn't know if I was even good enough. I knew I played decent, but who knows, you know.
Well, so when you get there, well, let me go back a little bit.
Yeah.
Now, as a young pedal steel player, who were you listening to? Who were you trying to emulate or what?
Well, at that time, there was about three big steel players. There was Buddy Emmons,
mm-hmm.
I'd say big, famous.
Right.
A guy named Jimmy Day, mm-hmm. who played similar to Buddy Emmons. Then there's a guy on the West Coast called Ralph Mooney.
Mm-hmm.
He had a style that really... These other guys, they could play about anything. They could play melodies. They could play fast. But Ralph Mooney just had a style where he played licks.
Mm.
If you heard him play on one song, you've heard him play on just about everything. But he had a style that would stood out. He played on the... He started out playing with a guy named Win Stewart.
Mm-hmm.
That was a... He actually came from Bakersfield, that era, and
right.
played in Vegas for a while, and then he recorded in L.A. He had a big record called Wishful Thinking back in the early 50s. But Ralph Mooney played that style. You might call it a hokey style in a way, but it was just licks. It wasn't a melody of any sort. Most of these other players would fill with kind of a... if so, I would sing a line, they'd kind of fill a melody line that was similar to what the guy just sang.
Mm-hmm.
But Ralph would play licks. He'd just play not fancy, but just outstanding licks.
Uh-huh.
It were just pedal pulls.
Right.
And stuff like that, like you'd bend a guitar string.
Mm-hmm.
Just effects more than anything.
That sounded very, very much like the instrument. Very idiosyncratic.
Oh, yeah,
the sound of the pedal steel.
That's what the pedal steel does, is pull those notes.
Right.
You know? So he was just using it as it was set up to do.
Right.
But the other guys were a little bit more sophisticated players. That didn't take anything away from Ralph Mooney's playing, but they played more melodic.
Right.
Well,
so
Ralph played outstanding licks.
So you kind of combined all those things.
Yeah, I tried to play like any of them. It depends on who I was playing with and what song they were singing.
Sure.
And me not have played long enough, or anybody here heard me play, to have so-called a style, I had to copy all these people.
Right.
And when you work with the Grand Ole Opry people, they kind of expect you to play their records the way they were recorded.
Right.
When we played live, because I hadn't really got in the studio then, and the Nashville producers wasn't going to trust a new musician until you could prove yourself somehow.
Right.
But in fact, when I was working with Roy Drusky, I tried my best to get him to used me on some of his recording sessions, but he said his producer wouldn't allow him to do it. And I understand that, because they can't take a chance. They're obligated to the record company to get a certain amount of songs done at a certain length of time for a certain price. And they can't take a chance on somebody that might show up, can't do the job, and then they'd have to replace him or go into extra expense.
Right.
So I understand it.
So in those days, those recording sessions, I mean, people think about like Zoom, putting something on a digital and sending it through email. At those times, y'all were cutting on, were those mono recordings?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Everybody had to do it at one time.
Right. So you'd have a big room. How many musicians would be in the room at one time? Maybe like 15?
Well, yeah.
Sometimes?
Well, let's take a Roy Orbison session, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
On one of his records, you might hear a tremolo guitar. You might have somebody else playing guitar licks. You may have a bass guitar just kind of doubling the electric bass or the upright.
The upright,
really.
Right.
And
maybe a tic-tac bass, too, yes. Sometimes.
So
third
you had
one.
To have a person for each one of those posts.
Right.
You couldn't, there wasn't
no overdubs.
Like we called it overdubs, where you could add your part later. That
right.
came many years later.
Right.
So, yeah, what you wanted on that record had to be in the studio.
And everybody had to do their part perfectly every time you rolled tape, because you didn't want to be the guy who. You wouldn't last long if you were
You wouldn't last long, and you wouldn't be very popular at that moment if you caused many retakes.
Right.
Because one person messed up, that's what it took.
You know, even me thinking about at the beginning of my career, my recording career, it was all on tape, a 24-track or 16-track tape. And, editing was all destructive. At if you did an overdub, you necessarily had to go over what you'd already played, so you had to be someone who could not only fix a mistake if there was one, but do it in a way. Anyway, I think about the way we do it now. You can do one or two takes, and guys like, oh, we got it there, we can cut and paste. And I think, we used to have to walk out there and be an adult and stand in front of the microphone or stand up on the floor and play it from start to finish without any mistakes. That's how we were trained.
Oh, that's right. And I'll tell you how instilled that was in most people's minds. There was a lot of records that, I say a lot, there were a few that were released with mistakes on them.
Oh, sure.
Because the record felt so good.
Right.
And it wasn't a big outstanding mistake. But that was so instilled in even artists' minds till in later years, I wound up being on a compilation album with several artists. One of them was a guy named Webb Pierce,
who
had records in the early 50s that we're talking about.
Right.
Where they had to do it all the way through. This was like in probably the late 70s, early 80s, I'm talking about. So Webb probably wasn't tuned in. He didn't do as many studio singing sessions, he wasn't as popular as he was, so he wasn't tuned into the new way of recording.
Mm-hmm.
So we were recording multi-track,
mm-hmm.
you know, several where you could fix your part.
Right.
Well, somebody mentioned, I might have been me or something, I need to redo that section, you know, so-and-so.
Mm-hmm.
Webb said, well, he ain't talking like that. He said, well, if it ain't got a mistake on it, it ain't going to be a hit anyway.
Right.
He was instilled into that old way of thinking. You know?
Sure, sure, sure. Well, yeah, humans aren't attracted to perfection. Humans are attracted to humanity.
There you go.
So,
yeah.
You know, if the track has life to it, it's breathing, you know, the human mind will gloss over something that a slight imperfection for the greater purpose.
Well, that's what they went for at the time. And they still do, but now
sure.
We have the capability of redoing parts
right,
and almost
right.
reconstructing the song.
Sure, sure.
But that's what they thought in the day, and the record company wanted that. They just wanted something that felt good, that would get a lot of airplay
right.
and sell records and make the artists popular enough to tour.
Right. Know? Well, let's, man, this, it's such a pleasure let's take a little break here, and everybody out in the Feral Nation knows what to do. Go get yourself another drink, and we'll be right back.
South of Highway 90, a little east of the Regalies, in a bubble nearly off of the map, we're flying on a trapeze. It's fine to be living in the sunshine, catch a few breakers breaking in the brine, cruise the coast in the Cat of Carolina, cruising over the state of mind line. You can feel it when you're crossing the border, never too late to leave it behind. A simple cure for a state of disorder when you cruise over the state of mind line.
We're back inside the Feral Zone, back with our guest, the great Doyle Grisham, and my special guest, Ned Henry. I'm not sure which one is more special. They're both very special. I am Renee Coleman, and as always in the podcast, you know, this is a listener-supported operation. We have the Venmo and PayPal links right there in the show notes of every show. We have the Patreon links. We have the Troubleman Podcast t-shirt link. All that stuff. Follow us on social media, Facebook, Instagram, and rate, review, and subscribe to the podcast wherever you're listening to it. Give us 5 stars. Helps us a lot. Costs you nothing. And you can find all my dates this summer on my Renee Coleman Facebook page or the Iguanas dates page, iguanas.com. Enough of that. Back to our guest, the great Mr. Doyle Grisham, sitting here with Ned Henry. Great Ned Henry. And so Doyle, we were talking about your career in Nashville there. So you get into the recording scene. Now, I know you played with the great Lynn Anderson for many years.
Yes.
Out on the road.
Yeah, I toured with her back in the mid-70s till she passed away in the 2010 or somewhere
yeah.
in that area. But no, she'd been a friend. She was one of the first people I met when I came to Nashville.
Yeah.
In fact, she worked for a publishing company that had a record label called Chart Records. And I think that might have been the first label that Paycheck was on.
Mm.
But anyway,
mm-hmm.
back in those days, to make extra money, I wrote what they call lead sheets.
Mm-hmm.
You had to get a song published. Now you just send in a cassette or a CD of that song, and they have to have a physical recording of the song to copyright your song.
Right.
Back in those days, you had to have a lead sheet. It had to be written out
with the melody
with the
and
notes
the chords.
And the melody and the chords.
And the
so
words.
So I did that on the side to make some extra money, and Lynn Anderson was a secretary at this Charlie record label thing. And actually, they had an office right across the hall from Roy Drusky, who I was playing with on the Opry, and a guy named Lloyd Green, who was the top, one of the top steel players at that time around Nashville, and still is.
Yeah.
But she was across the hall, so when I'd go to visit Roy Drusky or go to visit Lloyd, I'd stop in to say hello to her, and she found out that I could do this lead sheet thing, so I made a few bucks. You know, she'd give me songs to write so they could publish.
Right.
You know, but you had to get them copywritten, you know. Mm-hmm. So that's how I met Lynn.
Now, I guess Nashville is kind of one of those towns like New Orleans, a small town within that community.
It is. At that time, when I moved there, there was only 300,000 people there.
Right. So if you got any kind of good or bad reputation in that town, the word traveled fast.
It moved.
Right. right.
Yes, it would.
And man, looking at this list of people that you were recorded with during that period, it's crazy. Besides Lynn Anderson, England Dan, John Ford Coley, Dr. Hook.
Yeah. I didn't know you had all those.
Peter Yarrow from Peter, Paul, and Mary.
Yeah.
All these people. And that's when you first encountered Jimmy Buffett, huh? You first played on his records in the early 70s.
During that time frame, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yep. It was probably about 72.
Okay.
In that area. How I met Jimmy, I was working with a group on the Grand Ole Opry. Now, this was after I'd worked with Roy Drusky, had already gone in the service, done my time, and I was...
Now, did you have to go to Vietnam?
No, I was in during that time frame.
Right.
But, no, I was... actually, I got sent to an Airedale squadron, and I was a typist. They call them a yeoman in the Navy. And they just happened to, when they pulled my billet to send me somewhere, they sent me to this Naval Air Squadron. It's just a division of the Navy. It wasn't a real Navy, although I was a real Navy, in the essence of speaking. But, no, I spent my whole... I think I was telling Ned, I spent my whole active duty and reserve time... It never was on the ship, but I was in the Navy.
Nice. Yeah. Well, good thing, because we needed you in the music business. You know? couldn't have you turn out to be cannon fodder. So you're meeting Jimmy after you'd done your time in the service.
Yep, I was working with a group called Tom Paul and the Glazer Brothers. Hmm. Now Tom Paul went on to be associated with Willie Nelson in that outlaw thing, and you know, when that first started. But anyway, at this time, we're talking about 1971, 72, we were recording with Tom Paul and the Glazer Brothers. Because I got to play on their, they had a deal with the record label where I could play on their records.
Nice.
And even though I was just in their band and hadn't really done an immense amount of popular studio work where people would know I was on the record.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, we were recording The Christian and Tin Cup Chalice, two of Jimmy Buffett's songs he had written. Well, I didn't know him. You know, I'd never even heard of him. And we took a break, and this guy walked up to me and said, "Hi, I'm Jimmy Buffett. I just signed a major recording deal with ABC Dunhill Records, and I'd like you to play on my next record." That was surprising to me because I couldn't see. We wasn't that far into the session. I couldn't see where he had heard me play enough to even want me to be associated with him. But I'll be darned, about 2 months later, or a month or so, they called me and set up the sessions. And I did, from that time on, I did, I think, three other albums with him.
Up to
about 75, he changed producers. Norbert Putnam started producing him instead of Don Gant, and they cut Margaritaville, and that kind of pushed Buffett out of a kind of a country. He was almost country in his early days, but it pushed him more into kind of a pop rock country vein, you know. And actually, from that was about 1975. I didn't see much of him. he'd call me to do an occasional overdub, but I didn't see him until 99 when he asked me to tour with him.
Now, back in 99, you did some more recordings with him?
He called me back to do another complete album, mm-hmm. instead of just an overdub. And it's called Beach House on the Moon. And I didn't know it, but he was talking to people behind the scenes, said, I'm going to have him in the band.
Yeah. Now, the band at that time still had all Fingers Taylor was in the band. Mike Utley.
Robert Greenidge, who just unfortunately recently passed away.
Great pan steel player.
Best in the world, probably.
Right, right. So that's when my band, the Iguanas, was signed to Margaritaville starting in like 93. And so for about 4 years or so, we were opening for him, and all those guys were still on the band. So I got to hang around, have dinner with all those guys every day and see them play. And
they were there when I came in, too. And plus, I didn't know the Fingers and Mike Utley from the early Buffett recordings.
Right.
Back in 72 when Buffett really didn't even have a band. He was putting people on his label. On the album, he was naming his band Marvin Gardens and people like that. You know, he'd make up names.
Right.
Because he didn't even have a band.
Right.
And when he first started touring, he only took Fingers and a guy named Roger Bartlett, who was his first guitar player.
Okay.
And it was a long time, really, before he had a band, and probably the 80s or early 90s before he ever had the band that I came into in 99.
Uh-huh.
I mean, we had 12 people in the band.
Right, that was a big band. Still had the PM band, I think, was the rhythm section at that time.
Yeah, they were the Peter Murray group. They were from St. Louis.
Right.
When Buffett, I think it was in the 90s or so, he decided to make a change from his normal band, and they were already like a trio.
Right.
And he hired them kind of as the nucleus of the band, mm-hmm. and then built around that.
Right.
You know, kept Robert Greenidge and Utley and all those other people.
Fingers still, yeah.
Yeah.
So in 99, you start touring with Buffett. Now you'd spent years in Nashville managing the studio and touring with Lynn Anderson. And I know, like, during all that time, and I guess continuing when you were touring with Buffett, they don't tour 12 months a year. So you do a few months in, you go back to Nashville, do some sessions,
and that was
a good balance, huh?
Yeah, it was good. And one kind of helped the other, or at least working with Buffett didn't hurt me any.
Yeah.
And studio at that time, work had kind of, it started phasing out in the 90s, you know, because people could do it at home.
Mm-hmm.
The AI wasn't in them, but they could do home recordings. It took people that were doing studio work, took them out of the studio. A lot of people lost some of their accounts. And
right.
Plus some of the old-timers that used to play on all the records, they were getting up in years and passing away.
Right.
But I had to kind of split the difference a little bit, but we only toured about 10 weeks a year with Buffett. People think we were gone all the time, but we weren't. It was mainly from May until September. It was just a summer job, so to speak.
Right. Y'all would go out and play all those sheds.
Yeah. First year or two, we did 3 weeks at a time. We'd go out for 3 weeks, come back in. We might be off a month, and then we'd go out for 3 weeks more. Then it got down to where it was 2 weeks at a time.
Right.
And we went out a little bit more often, but it wasn't extensive. It was about 10 weeks a year.
Now, going back of some of these people that you recorded with, you know, during all the time you're playing with Lynn Anderson, and then during your Buffett tenure, mentioned some of them as in the intro, you know, George Jones, Reba McEntire, Randy Travis, Mel Tillis, Kitty Wells. I'm leaving some out, but I mean, giants. You know, what was it like working with when you recorded with Kitty Wells? Was that a big session?
Well, actually, I don't know how that got.
Oh, okay, there. All right, that's not correct.
Well, I tell you, I read one day where somebody had listed I played with Ernest Tubb.
Yeah,
he had carried a lot of famous musicians.
Uh huh.
That never happened either.
Okay. So, well, that's how it gets into the zeitgeist.
It sounds good, I'll accept it. It really didn't happen.
Okay, all right. But you did record with George Jones.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I did a little bit, you know.
Right, right. And then
I'd have to say I'll record with
right.
You.
And then an odd one here, Tiny Tim. Was that?
Oh, yeah.
You did record.
I did. But see what people don't, you know, to explain who Tiny Tim was, he had that tiptoe through the ceiling.
Right,
know,
right. Appeared on Johnny, got married on Johnny Carson show.
Yeah,
was a very famous cultural figure during the late 60s, early 70s.
Yep. But see, people don't realize he was like Jim Nabors. He was a pop singer.
Right.
His voice was as mellow as Jim Nabors, you know, if people ever really heard him sing. And so we were doing an album of pop music with Tiny Tim. I think he was using his real name, which I can't remember.
Right, I don't remember
but,
either.
In fact, I played more guitar on that than I did steel.
Okay, so on sessions, you were not playing exclusively pedal steel? You're still playing
some
electric guitar?
No, sometimes I'd play acoustic guitar,
mm-hmm.
and I might overdub steel.
Right.
Might be a session where they only needed steel on one song. And sometimes I might play an extra guitar or electric guitar or something. But anyway, this was... I was working for a producer that I would play guitar or steel for. And because it was more pop stuff, I think I wound up... Because he was doing stuff like some Ronstadt stuff and things that had guitar, you know...
Right, right.
Oriented and
sure, steel. Sure, sure. I guess steel kind of puts it into a certain genre right away. As soon as people hear that, they think, oh, this is a country record.
Yeah. But he was just a Dean Martin type of singer.
Yeah,
People don't realize that because he had his... fame doing that gimmick
novelty
stuff.
Hit yeah right right now this other record I want to talk about this Randy Travis duets record that you played on and which put you in now was that a thing where y'all cut all the tracks and then other people came and did the vocals or were you there
sometime they were there
so
we were
all these
recording.
People amazing Roy Rogers
yep.
Roy Rogers I mean were you around Roy
yep.
Rogers?
Oh, yeah.
Well, he must have been an advanced
he was a
age, huh?
And he was pretty funny on his
yeah.
own.
I mean, yeah.
And he come in dressed in his Roy Rogers.
Really?
Yeah. He lived the part.
Full singing cowboy attire.
Yeah.
Nice.
And Dolly Parton was there, Chet Atkins.
Vern Gosden. Yeah,
Vern
yeah,
Gosden.
Yeah. Yeah, man. Chiseled in Stone. I love that song, Chiseled in Stone.
Oh, he was a great singer.
Oh, man, incredible.
One of my favorite. But, and then a lot of other people. I tell you a funny story, though, mm-hmm. about who's the blues guitar player?
B.B. King.
B.B. King.
Mm-hmm.
He was on that.
Yeah.
Well,
nice.
we were recording or starting to record, and I noticed... They had me down in the mix a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes they would route everybody out to a mixer that was at your station, and you could turn yourself up.
Right.
I'm not sure if that was the case or not during this time. But anyway, I didn't say anything because I knew I could, if I couldn't hear well enough to play, I could always, Mike could redo my part. And I figured they had me down because they didn't want to offend
BB,
BB, he might not like steel. Well, I'll be down, out of the blue. He said, turn that steel guitar up. I want to hear some country music.
Right.
I could just see everybody in there turning red with rage. You know? But no, he actually said that.
Nice.
Yeah.
And so Chet Atkins, you know, the master, what was your experience with him?
I really didn't see Chet that much.
Yeah,
you know?
Okay.
Let me put it this way. I was a Chet Atkins. When I started playing guitar, his style was one of the first I learned to play. So at 14 years old, I could play it sounded like Chet Atkins.
Right.
And when I came to Nashville, though, I used to pitch some songs every now and then for this Glazer publishing company. And at that time, you could actually walk in or maybe call ahead and make an appointment with Chet Atkins. To just sit down and he would take it was reel-to-reel tapes.
Uh-huh.
He would take a tape, play it. If he'd play about 30 seconds to a minute. If they saw something they liked, they'd say, I'll keep that. Or if they didn't, they'd take it off and sell it. No,
he was still listening to song pitches.
Yeah, and I was around him a lot on some of the TV shows, but I never talked to him a lot.
Yeah.
And I would like to have, but I just didn't like to bug those people.
Sure, sure.
In the same way on the Randy Travis sessions. Mm-hmm. He was there, but I didn't really speak to him.
Right,
much.
Right. Now, it's interesting how many guitar players of all these different genres, you ask them and they go, well, Chet Atkins, you know?
Yeah.
Like Johnny Winter, you yeah. know? He talks about he played the way he played technically because of Chet Atkins. Sonny Landreth, when I talked yeah. to him, he said Chet Atkins.
Well, it's like when I was playing guitar. You know, Chet had that style. It was kind of a thump style where you play the
bass
with your thumb.
Right.
And you pick the notes with your fingers. Well, that was his style, but I learned a lot. When Chet wasn't using that style, he was playing other things that had neat harmonies to them. So mm-hmm. I learned a lot about different versions of harmonies by listening to some of his records.
All the inversions he could
yeah,
play. All
he
the,
didn't always play that one style.
Right.
He would, you know, just stretch out and play like a normal guitar player.
Right. Man, oh man. Well, we're kind of on the downslope of the podcast here, yeah. wrapping up. But, you know, I could talk to you for 5 hours.
yeah.
And maybe we'll come back. Well, you know, Ned was saying yesterday we weren't sure we were going to be able to pull this off here and this early in the morning. He was saying, well, if this gig goes well, which it looks like, I mean, the gig is very well subscribed so far. We have lots of tickets sold. You know, all indications are this is going to be a big hit tonight. I had people calling my wife yesterday going, so this band that Renee's playing with, that looks incredible.
It is incredible.
And so we're going to do that tonight, and hopefully, you know, we'll be able to come back and in the fall, maybe do another one and have you back, Doyle, have you
yeah,
on the podcast.
I appreciate
again.
You rearranging your schedule to do it this morning.
Oh, well. Man,
yeah,
you know, this is you have to seize life, seize opportunities, as we've discussed already. So Ned, to have Doyle here sitting in your home and playing on your gig tonight, it's got to be a dream come true for you.
Well,
huh?
This whole thing is amazing. I mean, first of all, I mean this all you guys playing with me on this project, all you guys,
yeah,
you and John Groh and John Fall and Russ, Dex Daly. Is incredible, and have Doyle in this is, I mean, I can't imagine for me a more full circle
right
kind of moment. I mean,
right.
I've been a Jimmy Buffett fan since I was a little kid.
Yeah.
When I met him at a restaurant, and he was friendly to me, and then he played guitar at the restaurant after dinner.
Yeah.
And when I was looking at colleges when I was in high school, we planned our college tour around Buffett shows,
huh.
all up and down the East Coast,
yeah.
driving up and down in a van. And I've loved pedal steel. It's always been my favorite instrument since I was a little kid.
Yeah.
And to become acquainted with and then become a friend of Doyle is absolutely amazing. And I mean, that's a dream come true for
it sure. goes both ways.
Well.
Because he's got great songs and I enjoy playing on them. They're so melodic. It gives me room to think and to play what I feel.
Yeah. Right, right. Yeah, I was going to compliment you on the record came out so good, man. I was, you know, it has, I was telling you the other day in rehearsal, like listening to the whole thing a couple of times, you know, hearing it finished, which I never heard it finished until recently. You know, I did my part and we moved on, you know, and you put all this other stuff on it, hear it back, and it's all mixed. And it's like, wow, man, that really holds up, man. It really, and it has a quality that for some reason I can't put my, well, I can possibly, but this Beach Boys record, The Beach Boys Love You, which was recorded as a solo Brian Wilson record that then the record company said, well, we need a Beach Boys record, so let's take this and put all the guys singing on it. We'll overdub them and that. But it has a certain, like, playful innocence to it, but an earnestness, you know, humor has all this stuff, and the playing is great, and the songs are, you know, really hold up, man. And your singing is really solid. You know.
Well, I really appreciate it, but y'all are the ones that really brought this to life. And I really appreciate the Beach Boys comment, because people ask me what kind of music it is, and I never know what to say, but I've been a Beach Boys fan forever. I really, really love harmony.
Sure.
And maybe that comes through in the music.
Yeah, yeah. There's a lot of that stuff, and some of the voicings of the vocals are maybe that's part of what catches me or something. But yeah, there's something ineffable about it that I just started dawning on me. Oh wow, that for some reason this reminds me of that. Even though I know you're not going for that, but you know, it's American music, so you know it's all cross pollinated in every possible way. Well, man, looking forward to playing the gig tonight, and so glad to have met you, Doyle, and thanks again for coming on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So for our guests, the great Doyle Grisham, the great Ned Henry, I am Renee Coleman from Inside the Feral Zone, signing off.
I woke up trapped.